Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, on the road, producing a new documentary. Today, we're going to talk about how vitamin E's specific form, tocotrienols, shows breast health benefits. Then we're going to look at how eating legumes can make a big difference in controlling the impact of your heart and diabetes. We're also going to explore how simple changes by our diet can really reverse our aging process. But today's commentary day. No guests, so we're going to talk, for example, from the Observer on our environmental segment about, I'm going to give you the American cities that are running out of water. And also around the world, some big cities are literally down to day zero. And that's happening as of 5 weeks from now. Could you imagine one of the biggest cities in Africa, one of the most prosperous cities, will have no water in 5 weeks? Not a word in the American media. Talking about water, Donald Trump wants to sell our water to Wall Street. Food and Water Watch, Trump's infrastructure scam is dangerous for our communities and workers and the environment. I'll share 5 points of why we should not privatize any of these rebuilding structure projects. Also, every night, every day, on every single network, you have so-called experts. These experts' background are never questioned. The accuracy of their predictions in the past or policies they supported are never challenged. Paul Craig Roberts, a brilliant mind, one of the best progressive thinkers on the planet, takes issue. His commentary? American think tanks are hired purveyors of fake news. And the American public pays taxes in order to be brainwashed, and they tolerate it. Then, from Fran Whitaker Wood of Alternet, a new map reveals which countries are most likely to survive climate change. I read her article, and I found it very compelling. And from Eric Levitz from New York Magazine, we must cancel everyone's student debt for the economy's sake. Also, when I was listening to some of the pundits talk about how people wanting to migrate from other countries, specifically Mexico, into the United States, they have to go through this torturous process, which is just stupid at every level. It's been mismanaged completely. I'll give my solutions to how to handle those individuals wishing to come to the United States, and how you can also help prepare them in their own countries so when they come, they can speak English, they understand our culture, and therefore understand, is this a culture they want to come to? Because when you don't have an assimilation of cultures where you can share some common ideals, some common standards, then you end up like Sweden is today. The last time I visited Sweden, I could walk anywhere at any time without any fear. Can't do that today. That's because they looked at what was politically correct instead of what was realistic. But a part of that whole dynamic was that somehow we have to protect American citizens from people living in Mexico. From Shane Quinn, the Duran, America's Forgotten War with Mexico. Let's put all this in proper perspective, an honest perspective. And that's what I think we can get to. Plus, we also have some audio clips coming at you today. But we always begin with the latest on health and healing. Vitamin E is quite simply one of the most important nutrients you can ever have. I never will forget the time I put together a health conference, and each of the individuals that were invited from Linus Pauling and Albertson Georgi, who won the Nobel Prize for discovering ascorbic acid, and the Shute brothers, Evan and Wilfred Shute from Canada, who had done more research on vitamin E than anyone else in world history. They published over 3,000 monograms on it. plus the man who invented vitamin B6, folic acid. I had all these specialists who came to New York. I rented a room at the Waldorf Astoria, and it was packed. It was a 10-hour conference, not a wasted second. I don't know if anyone in the audience listening right now was there then, but if you were there, you really benefited. And what was particularly impressive during that series of talks, there were 12 people, was the Shoup brothers. They brought up over 1,000 slides to show people had gangrene, that were going to have their leg amputated, and then showed you what happened after they got vitamin E put on the wound as well as internally taking it, but at doses that no one in science had ever used, 1,000, 2,000 milligrams. They all are units. They also show people with end-stage heart disease and using vitamin E. It was extremely compelling. So that was 40 years ago. Today, most people are still ignorant about vitamin E, and it's not regularly recommended. This is just one study by researchers in Ancona, Italy. And here's what they say. They say the vitamin E tocotrienols, toco, T-O-C-O, tri, T-R-I-N-O-L-S, E-N-O-L-S, from Anatto, A-N-N-A-T-T-O, may slow the development and reduce the number and size of breast tumors. The vitamin E forms were also linked to a significant reduction in levels of a marker for pathogenesis and progression of certain breast cancers called human epidermal growth factor receptor 2, or HER2. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Carcinogenesis. Quote, in this paper, we demonstrate for the first time the anti-cancer activity of the Anatto T3 supplementation in a spontaneous breast tumor model. Well, there's tocotrienols and there's tocopherols and tocotrienols. They are both extremely potent antioxidants. You can get them all in the same tablet. I'm suggesting that we use a combination of both at 400 to 800 units a day. There are 8 forms of vitamin E, just so you know. 4 are tocopherols. You have alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And there are 4 tocotrienols, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. And there's also an alpha tocopherol TOC, T-O-C. And that's what's in most of the supplements. So get your mixed tocopherols and take them daily, and you can help your heart, your blood pressure. You can help slow down oxidative stress and slow down the aging process. It also helps your arteries, especially the epithelium, the inside lining of your arteries. One of the reasons that we die so young in our society is because of heart disease. It's that simple. But what is the primary cause of heart disease? It's inflammation. Now, there are different ways of becoming inflamed. Smoking, drinking, pesticides, fried foods, a meat-based diet, french fries, these all can cause inflammation. But inflammation is the way your body responds to any challenge, whether battling an infection or cancer or healing from a bone fracture. Your body needs to deliver powerful immune and repair cells to the impaired location throughout your bloodstream in order to fix the problem. According to Michael Smith of Life Extension, inflammation is really designed to be an acute process that gets in and out quickly. What do I mean? I mean that the longer the immune and repair cells stay in a location, the greater the chance they'll actually cause damage to surrounding healthy tissue and cells. Chronic inflammation, that's what you have with arthritis and bursitis and chronic pulmonary congestion. Simply put, it's an acute inflammation. And that leads to damage and disease. And this is why we call chronic inflammation the common denominator of all age-related disorders. But where it really plays havoc is on your blood vessels. Let me give you just a little tutorial here. All your tissues and organs are very susceptible to inflammatory damage. but this is especially true for your heart and blood vessels. Chronic inflammation can damage the heart muscle cells and the heart valves and the inside lining of the arteries. As I just mentioned, those are your endothelium. And this can result in a progression of plaque buildup and high blood pressure and irregular heartbeat and murmurs and even congestive heart failure. So chronic inflammation can be detected through blood tests, and one of the most common tests is C-reactive protein. It is also a risk factor for heart disease. Where inflammation and heart disease risk are characterized by an elevated C-reactive protein. And that's why I suggest that twice a year, you get an inexpensive, easy-to-do test, and they'll tell you homocysteine, fibrinogen, triglycerides, and C-reactive protein. You don't want any of those elevated. There are two studies published in the New England Journal of Medicine that validate the role of C-reactive protein in increasing cardiovascular disease risk. And the findings simply show that people who attained the lowest level of C-reactive protein had significantly reduced rates of heart disease. And the studies also showed that reducing C-reactive protein levels just by itself, nothing else, cuts heart attack risk and slows the progression of atherosclerosis. And so one of the best ways to control inflammation is to watch what you eat and drink. Soft drinks and coffee, terrible. Fried food, terrible. Animal proteins, terrible. Sugars, terrible. Artificial sweeteners, terrible. Go with a natural, wholesome, plant-based diet. And then you have this chemical. It's called arachidonic acid. Arachidonic acid is the precursor to inflammation because it signals proteins like leukotrienes and cytokines to turn on. And when these signals are released into your bloodstream, inflammation increases and tissue damage occurs. And additionally, eating too much saturated fat or simple sugars and syrups can increase C-reactive protein. So avoid your saturated fats, avoid simple sugars, and just have a healthy diet, the one that we talk about every single day on this program. In fact, in one study, a 39% decrease in C-reactive protein levels after only 8 weeks of consuming a diet low in saturated fat and high in fiber. By the way, fiber is so important. Wow. Most people take it for granted. Don't. Here's the rule. For every meal that you consume, you should vacate the previous meal. And people are not doing that. And as a result, they get all forms of autotoxic reactions by putrefaction and degradation of what they've eaten. And since most people eat saturated fat and animal proteins, you have a real bacteria-laden, toxic group of substances in your intestine. So the fiber sweep that out, cleanses it out. Blueberry fiber, strawberry fiber, all good. So you can win the battle against inflammation by making sure you have your omega-3 fatty acids, curcumin, Boswellia, B-O-S-W-E-L-L-I-A, vitamin C, and quercetin, and black cumin seed oil. That's your top five to turn off inflammation in your body. Those are the powerful inflammatory cytokines that inhibit the five locks. And so we could save 1 million lives a year if we did what I just suggested. Now, legumes, actually, people are a little confused. You hear the word legume, beans, and they're all the same. So the higher consumption of legumes, L-U-G-U-M-E-S, you can improve your glycemic control and reduce the risk of heart disease. There was a randomized controlled trial published in the Journal of the American Medical Association's Archives of Internal Medicine, backed by the use of legumes, to help lower glycemic index of foods. By increasing this, split peas, lentils, every kind of bean, black-eyed peas and navy beans, pinto beans, soybeans, fava beans, kidney beans, they're all good. They're great for people with diabetes, great for people overweight, and great for people who want to lower their blood sugar. All good. So let's get those. And finally, exercise boosts satisfaction with life. Now, I spend a lot of time alone. I remember there was a film back in the 1970s called Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner. I think Tom Courtney was the star of it. And in it, it was about a person that was training, running. Well, a lot of us train. More often than not, you're going to train alone unless you have a buddy system, and that's really great if you do. For 10 years, Franco Pantoni, a great athlete, a top athlete, and I trained together almost every day and did all kinds of races and marathons and won in every single race we were in. In fact, we had an unbeatable team. There were three of us. There was Tacky, Franco, and myself. I don't care whether it was a 40K national championship or the 10K, a 20K up in Niagara Falls. We won about 60 races. But to do that, you have to train long. So it was nothing at all to go out and train 18 miles every day on the road. But what you're doing is you're also getting into a zone. So after about 6 miles, your hormones, your natural endorphins, these are the body's natural opiates, begin to flood the bloodstream. And you're feeling just at peace, at ease. You're just gliding. And that's one of the reasons that they call it a runner's high. It's a natural high. Now, if you did a long race, you could have those all day long. And that's why a lot of people who work in stressful positions like to go for a good workout in the morning, because you're creating endorphins that gives you a better emotional disposition. So if you're having a bad day, just extending your normal exercise routine by maybe 10 minutes can be the solution. Penn State researchers found that people's satisfaction with life was higher on days when they exercised more than usual. Quote, "We found that people's satisfaction with life was directly impacted by their daily physical activity. The findings reinforce the idea that physical activity is a health behavior with important consequences for daily well-being and should be considered when developing national policies to enhance satisfaction with life." End quote. So get out and exercise. Whatever type of exercise you have to do, do it. And this was published in Health Psychology. And to our friend who is 93, going on 94, who has end-stage Alzheimer's, you've made remarkable improvements. But go out every day with your wife to do your workout. He's listening right now. Get up out of that chair, and after this program, get out there and do 4 miles. All right? It's helping you. And to all the good people having birthdays today, another year, including one of our chefs, Valentino. So all of you who are at your birthday, happy birthday. For everyone who's going out for a workout, you're going to feel better today. For everyone taking your vitamin E, you're going to protect your heart and your lining and prevent strokes. By understanding the power of curcumin and black cumin seed oil, boswellia, you're going to help diminish the chances of having secondary problems from inflammation. So a lot of people helped if you just apply what was shared. We're going to take a break and come right back. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us. Today is commentary day. I have a lot of commentaries, but also I just want to give you an idea of some of the quality people that we have coming up. Tomorrow we have Vanessa Beely, B-E-E-L-E-Y. She's going to talk about the truth about Syria in the Middle East. She's there. She's been traveling there doing reporting. And she will tell us the truth. She will not lie like the reporters for CNN, Wall Street Journal, or those who praise the White Helmets, which is just a terrorist organization. She's the one who broke the story with three other people corroborating her statements, other journalists who also were there. So we're going to get that tomorrow. Tonight at 7 p.m. on the Progressive Commentary Hour, we're going to have Dr. Michelle Perreault. She is a 35-year practicing board-certified pediatrician, and we're going to talk with her about why our children are getting sick. And specifically, she's going to give us a whole tutorial on genetically modified foods and glyphosate and our gut health, how to build healthier gut in your bacteria in your system, how to get well. So I don't know a person that couldn't benefit from this discussion. It's a 1 hour just with her. And no, she's actually bringing another person on, Professor Venkan Adams, a professor of medical anthropology at the University of California and at San Francisco Medical School. And they're going to also talk about what are the foods that make you sick and why? What are the foods with the best bacteria? How much bacteria do you need? What kind of bacteria do you need in order to live a longer life? So that's tonight at 7 on PRN.FM. And by the way, we now have an app for PRN.FM on your cell phone. Go to the cell phone that you have. Look under the listings and it'll say store on your cell phone. That's where you get all your apps. And there you see PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, PRN.com. And that way, anywhere you are in the world, at any time, you just go to your own cell phone and you can listen. So that's tonight. Tomorrow, I mentioned that tomorrow we're going to have Vanessa Beely. And then on Thursday, I'm going to have Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science, on, because over the weekend, I took a break for a couple of hours, and I began to read some of the more serious and honest science on environmental issues. And as I was sitting at my desk, I began to make an organizational chart. And each one of the problems I put on the chart, for example, acidification of our oceans and global warming and the melting of the Arctic and release of methane in Siberia and the great tundras and the Arctic, the melting of Antarctica, the melting of Greenland, and the erosion of our soil, and the excessive cold and the excessive heat, both caused by global warming, the excessive rain, the intensity of the storms, the typhoons and hurricanes, the rising of the sea level, how that's going to make Dubai completely uninhabitable. And I must have had 40 different topics on this organizational chart. In fact, I had to get another chart. And these are 3-foot by 3-foot wide charts I make when I'm doing my research. And then under each one, I put what, on a scale of 1 to 10, have we been told the truth? Meaning, have we been told this is not a problem? Look, you're 40 years old. You will be dead and buried 50 years before anything happens that would impact your life. And then we've been looking for the truth, which is never told. This is happening now. It's just if you're not in the place where it's happening, you won't pay attention to it. Well, I happen to have been in the place where it happened twice in 1 year. The worst fire in Florida history, and then the worst hurricane in Florida history coming right up the West Coast, Category 4, 158-mile-an-hour winds. And the insurance company said that my property, because it's so large, because I planted 5,000 trees and thousands of shrubs, that's my hobby, that's how I relax, is gardening, that I had the most damage. Well, I've cleaned up almost all the damage. In fact, I'm going to take photographs next week, and I'll put before and after, and you'll see what it looked like the morning after the storm and what it looks like today. So the good news is awful lot of cleanup, but then it comes back. But what about the people where it doesn't come back, where you don't have those skills, where you can't run a bobcat or a forklift, or you can't work a bulldozer, or you don't know how to use a chainsaw, you don't know how to trim, you don't know how to graft, you don't know how to save a tree. You're overwhelmed. A truck pulls up and says, hey, you know, you got 10 trees down, we'll take them away. And you think, okay, I don't know what to do, but they're going to charge you $2,000 a tree. Suddenly you think, well, hold on, I don't have $20,000. Well, if you let those trees lay there, you're going to get a fine from the county. and you got to get a chainsaw and cut them up and neatly stack them out by the road, 6 feet off the road. But are they going to pick them up? No, they'll pick some of it up. They're going to leave a lot. What am I supposed to do? Now multiply that times 5 million in just Florida, or 7 million in Houston, or 11 million in Louisiana. And you think, wow, I didn't know all this was happening, because we don't make it an issue. When was the last time you saw videos of people living in Puerto Rico? All recovered, all the homes rebuilt, all the water back, all electricity? No, 38% of the country is still as bad as it was, and even worse after the hurricane, because it was such a miserable event and we failed at every level. So after I made my chart, I realized that we've been lied to intentionally with malice aforethought by every single major environmental organization and environmentalist in the country. No one's telling us the truth. They don't believe we can handle the truth. They believe that we would freak. Well, some people might, but there's nothing anyone's going to do about it based upon our current culture of living in hubris and denialism. Someone just misread the psyche of most Americans. We're indifferent until it happens to us, and then we scream as if we're a victim. So the only person I know who will give us 100% honesty is Guy McPherson. And I don't know what he's going to say. I'm going to ask him. You'll hear when I hear, how bad is it? The last time I spoke with Guy, and I said, Guy, how long do we have before major parts of our society are no longer able to be sustainable? He said, 9 years. Now, that does not mean the earth ends in 9 years. It doesn't mean everything goes down the rabbit hole in 9 years. It means that whole segments of the population will no longer be able to live where they are because it will have gotten so bad in certain areas. Well, he's correct, but let's see what his new predictions are. So that gives you a preview of some of the things coming. Before I go to my commentaries, let's go over and say hello to Elizabeth, who is standing by. And Elizabeth takes your questions, your comments. You go to prnstudio@gmail.com, prnstudio@gmail.com, and you send her whatever you want her to read on the air. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Gary. First of all, we had a very quick call, actually, from a gentleman who's a retired journalist. His name's Richard. He said that he really appreciated your honest and direct, in-depth insights into the HSBC and Valiant, sort of behind the scenes of them. And he says that he no longer trusts the mainstream media that he once worked with because they didn't cover such things. And he says that he wants to thank you for bringing to our attention that the Attorney General's office and other official organizations like that were working with the lawyers for these corporations, and that he wasn't aware of that. And then the second thing is, we had a person asking, a gentleman called Peter says, if you could name one artist who is unique and inspires you, who would it be? So two separate things there.
Well, that's not easy, because you have, from the 13th to the 16th century, you have some of the greatest artists, classical artists, meaning if they painted a tree, it was not abstract, it was not cubism, it was not impressionism, it looked like a tree. You had Giotto, di Bonone, and he was one of the first what was called real painters. I would think his would be phenomenal. Leonardo da Vinci. For better or worse, Leonardo will be forever known as the author of the most famous painting of all time, the Mona Lisa, or the Gioconda. But he was much more than that. He was a humanist. He was a scientist. He was a person that had one of the most unique minds in all world history. But you also had Albrecht Dürer, the real Leonardo da Vinci of Northern European Renaissance. He was an innovative genius, master of drawing and color. He would be one of my favorites. Also, you had Titan. And Titan became the leading figure of Venetian painting in his time, a unique way of using color, and his taste for mythological themes defined the main features of the 16th century Venetian art. And he influenced later artists like Rubens and Velasquez, and Michelangelo was one of the best. He painted not just the frescoes and the Sistine Chapel, but he was creative. Raphael, Caravaggio. The Impressionist movement, however, was different. That was in the 19th century. And Monet, Vincent, Van Gogh, not the most nice person to be around. Van Gogh was a problem, but he was extremely prolific, especially of his landscapes and his still lives. Wheat fields, sunflowers, De Gaulle, the French artist, famous for his paintings and sculptures and drawings. And he identified with the subject of dance. In fact, almost half of all of his work was to depict dancers. And Gauguin, Henri Paul Gauguin, was a French post-imperialist, impressionist artist, not very well appreciated until the transition from his life to his death. Then he became very famous. Chazanne, the French artist and post-impressionist painter. I can appreciate their work, though it wouldn't be the work that I would choose to put on my wall if I had my choice. I would put the classicalists. But these were people who were brilliant at creating symbolism in a movement. And this was about the same time as the Impressionist movement was the symbolist movement. And as opposed to the Impressionism, in which the emphasis was on the reality of the created paint surface itself, symbolism was both an artistic and literary movement that suggested ideas through symbols and emphasized the meaning behind the forms and lines and shapes and colors. And you had Gustav Klimt, K-L-I-M-T. His work I just saw recently over and on Fifth Avenue in the Vanderbilt Museum. I think it was in Vanderbilt. But it was beautiful, the murals, the paintings, just gorgeous work. And De Rivera, the Mexican painter, Frida, Moreau, these were all unique and wonderful and talented people. But if I had to have one from that era, I would say that my choice would be Henri de Lautrec. He died very young. He was only in his late 30s. He was probably the most unique because he came from royalty. His family was extremely famous, wealthy, but he was, some people say he was a dwarf, others say he had, and he said, that he had broken his legs as a child and his bones didn't heal correctly, and so his legs were immature. When I look at photographs, I tend to think that he had dwarfism, but I could be wrong. But what made Lautrec so unique is that coming from royalty, you were never supposed to work at anything that was considered a job. You were simply to maintain your estates and socialize, party. He didn't want any of that. He was a brilliant intellect. He had a phenomenal mind. And he went to Paris, and at that time, he wanted to get away from everything that represented entitlement. So he chose to hang with the people at the poorest end of society. His friends were prostitutes and pimps, and he would hang out in bars, and he painted them. And his most famous hangout, though it wasn't the most common one that he was at, was the Moulin Rouge. And there the owner would give him a seat right at the table, and they'd come out and do the can-can dances, and they would have jugglers and comedians and musicians, and he painted them. But then he would go to a racetrack and paint the horses, and he would go to the opera and paint people from the opera. He had an enormous capacity for work. He was one of the hardest working artists in history. And he also was one of the first to get his work out by doing lithographs, where the science didn't even exist at the time to do it, and he created the whole science. He was a phenomenal inventor. Quite simply, he was, in my opinion, Henry was one of the five greatest geniuses, artists in history. And he did so much illustration, draftsman, printmaking, and yet he was a lone person. He did have, at least to my knowledge, he had one short relationship with a prostitute who really abused him. She was verbally abusive. She would mock him. She would tell him that she was going to spend time with her sick sister and go out every day, and then she would go back to the streets. Interesting, because at that time, if you were a street hooker, you would get like 1 to 3 francs, and he would give her 100 francs, 1,000 francs, and she'd go and blow it on her boyfriend. And she'd come back and she'd say things. She was cruel. She would demean him. She would demean his stature. She considered him ugly. So you have to ask yourself, why would a person with such a brilliant gift and someone who is extremely humanistic and spiritual allow themselves to be in the presence of someone so manipulative? But he did, and he lived a short life. He was an alcoholic. He was lonely. He had low self-esteem, and his father couldn't stand the idea that he was a painter. Irony of ironies, his father disinherited him, didn't want anything more to do with him, had one meeting with him in his studio in Paris and said that you're an embarrassment, I never want to see you again. And then a couple years later, around 1900, 1901, he died in 1901, he became so famous, his father was unaware of it. And when he finally fell down some steps in a dead, drunk stupor, he was taken back home. And the father came in and said, I just read that the Louvre has accepted your work and is going to feature on permanent display your work. He said, I had no idea. And that was when he died. So people of that quality of talent, that mindset, stimulates. And that's why I would select him. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that's a great, thank you. What a tragic life. Thank you for telling us.
Tragic, but remember, all of us today can benefit from the fact that it was tragic, but look at what he created through his tragedy. He showed you the life, the real life. And you know the irony of it is, he did a poster of the Moulin Rouge, and he put it all around Paris. And so all the celebrities and the famous people came to the Moulin Rouge, and it changed the environment entirely, and he stopped going there. And the people originally worked there stopped working there because now everybody wanted something different. And so from what he loved being around, and by the way, he was a friend with all of the, you know, Monet and Gauguin, they were all his friends. And they were all poor, and they were all struggling, and they would all hang out together.
Cool.
So by making a place famous, it destroyed the ambiance. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Let's also take a look now at some cities running out of water. And this is from The Observer, and it says, quote, Cape Town, South Africa is running out of water. Sometime in April, it will face day zero, which means that the city's taps will be turned off and its 4 million residents will have no access to water. Civil unrest, riots, or worse, aren't just a possibility. They are inevitable unless there is a very quick fix. The country is rushing to the construction of water treatment plants and of desalinization plans to harvest drinkable water from the ocean, but these solutions should be implemented years, even decades ago. Well, first of all, you cannot build a desalinization plant in 4 weeks. It's more like 2 years. And yes, they're right on the water. They're right on Cape Town. They should have done this a long time ago. That's just corruption, inefficiency, a bureaucracy. Now, Cape Town isn't alone in racing towards an uncertain fate. All across the world, major cities are seeing their water resources shrink at an alarming rate. Where are the worst cases? Well, how about the biggest city in the world? 40 million people, Tokyo. How about London, Cairo, Sao Paulo, Beijing, and Mexico City are facing the prospect of an arid future. Each is from a different climate and on a different continent, but they are all sharing the same fate. Now, Cairo, I mentioned this a couple of months ago, but Cairo has been plagued by desertification and instability of irrigation, but now it has to do so with more mouths to feed and water that's needed. And down in Brazil, the capital, it gets even more rain than the U.S. Pacific Northwest, but the water isn't drinkable, thanks to pollution. And Beijing can no longer sustain its water supply as glaciers in Tibet are receding even faster than expected. And Mexico City was once built on a lake, but there's no place for the water to go thanks to construction on water recharge zones. So such activity also makes this area unstable and worsens the destruction from deadly earthquakes. Despite all of its rain, London's problems stem from a growing population. Tokyo gets as much rain as Seattle, Washington, but a lot of it comes during the brief monsoon period, and a weaker rainy season due to climate change could lead to Japanese cities being high and dry. But it's not just there. Here in the United States, which are the worst cities now and coming at you? El Paso, Texas, San Antonio, Texas, and Houston, Texas. It was 6 years ago that I stood in the Rio Grande on the border of Texas and New Mexico, just outside of El Paso. It was completely dry, even leftover bones of a few freshwater creatures indicated there had been a river there. It was nothing like the river that had been there in the 1970s and 80s that formed the famous border between U.S. and Mexico. And roughly 100 years ago, a congressional approval project known as Elephant Butte Reservoir was completed in southern New Mexico that allowed water to be diverted from the Rio Grande for agriculture. In the 1930s, Colorado, New Mexico, and Texas worked out a deal with Congress blessing it to share the water, but with the Rio Grande running dry, Texas recently sued New Mexico, claiming that the state is violating the deal by draining additional water before it gets to El Paso. So, and that's before the Supreme Court last month. And there are other large Texas towns that are in trouble. San Antonio is right upon the Edwards Aquifer, but the growth in population and a lack of recharge could, they're vulnerable. And also you have Houston. And then Salt Lake City, the capital of Utah. I drove through there not long ago, and kind of a sterile environment, but it's a victim of climate change. And what you have to understand is for every degree Fahrenheit of warming in that region, a 1.8 to 6.5% drop in annual water flow of local streams could occur. That means they're drying out. Atlanta, Georgia, 10 years ago, I remember going down to be on a PBS station, and I remember the program director drive me from the airport, and I said, you are aware that the Corps of Engineers said you only have about 3 weeks worth of water left, and they made a deal with Alabama and some other states to provide more water coming through their area, but there was a crippling drought. In fact, West Point Lake was nearly classified as a dead pool, so it's continued to grow and create suburbs without looking at the fact it's run out of water. It has a terrible sewage system, too. California, your biggest problem is Los Angeles and San Francisco. You're facing the worst drought in recorded history. You're struggling with the depletion of the Colorado River by several states for agricultural purposes, and San Francisco is dealing with historically low rainfalls. Miami, you'd think a city by the coast like Miami would be flush with water, but salt water can't be consumed, and moreover, those rising sea levels are seeping into the city's aquifer. So as the waves lap over city streets, the city's fresh water supply could disappear as fast as hurricanes headed to Florida. So those are some cities, but Boston and New York are moving forward to try to take some proactive action. Hopefully they will do so. But those are just some of the places that are running out of water. Now, in that respect, I'd like to challenge the legislators in Congress, Democrats and Republicans, because everybody wants to see an infrastructure, and we need one. What we don't need is the massive, massive profiteering that will occur if it's privatized. The private corporate or the private government partnerships, they're terrible. What is going to happen is Trump's scheme is to give Wall Street everything. And when they give it everything, they're going to privatize our water systems and public services so corporations can profit in perpetuity. And meanwhile, everyday people will pay the cost. You're going to have massive price increases, a lack of public accountability, and loss of jobs. And many of our water systems were built 100 years ago. That's literally no exaggeration. But the government has invested less and less into keeping our infrastructure up to date, meaning unaffordable water service rates and undrinkable tap water in places like Flint. They've already begun selling our roads and bridges and water systems off to the highest bidder. That is not a solution. And also, the plan will make water unaffordable, literally unaffordable. The bulk of this agenda is to raise rates and privatize public systems. So realistically, expect your water bill to double, triple. And that will make Wall Street profitable. It will not help the citizens. Also, Trump is attacking poor people and communities of color even as bad as the Clintons have manipulated them. Why? Because federal assistance would not go to places that need the support, but instead it would be prioritized to wealthier municipalities that can already pay for infrastructural projects. The only possible reason for this is that it's not a plan designed to improve people's lives. Low-income towns and communities of color pay higher water rates than their wealthier, whiter neighborhoods, and even within a community, the harm is not felt equally. Water shutoff disproportionately affects people of color in places like Boston and Detroit, and corporate investors driven by profit have no reason to put money into low-income and rural areas. And Trump's priorities are absolutely 100% wrong. I don't think this man's had an original idea in his life, and his plan provides no money dedicated to communities that need it most. It includes no provision that prioritizes communities with affordability or public health challenges. No, Trump's agenda will not help low-income cities like Flint or rural communities like Martin County, Kentucky, or other struggling communities. And so just so you understand, Trump's infrastructure plan will transfer wealth to rich, typically whiter communities. And this scheme cuts federal funding for public water. This plan will devastate the environment. So access to safe, affordable water should be protected. It will not be, and this will be a bipartisan effort to sell people out. For those of you who don't know history, I'd like to share a few thoughts. And we can thank Shane Quinn of the Duran for his meticulous scholarship. But it's a lesson we all need to learn. Once and for all, let's at least be honest about something. That we were not exceptional in how our society, how our country evolved. We stole it. And if anyone got in our way, we killed them. So America's war of expansion over Mexico is but one example. And everybody's in on the act, but no one's talking about its progenitor. So reflecting on his life while dying of throat cancer back in 1885, the former U.S. President Ulysses S. Grant said the Mexican-American War was, quote, this is his quote, the most wicked war in history. I thought so at the time when I was a youngster, only I had not moral courage enough to resign. Yeah, that's the President of the United States saying that. Now, President Grant had firsthand experience as he himself fought in the Mexican-American War, which is only a two-year war, 1846 to 1848. Then as a junior officer in his mid-20s. Now, less than two decades later, he rose to prominence as one of the most important figures during the American Civil War. He became commanding general of the Union Army. And Grant would also become a two-term American president from 1869 to 1877, initially taking the job with reluctance. He didn't want the job. And despite involvement in various conflicts, the Mexican-American War haunted Grant to the end. He said, quote, "I had a horror of the Mexican War, and I've always believed it was, on our part, most unjust. The wickedness was in the conduct of the war. We had no claim on Mexico. Texas had no claim beyond the Nueces River, and yet we pushed on the Rio Grande and crossed it. I am always ashamed of my country when I think of that invasion." Wow. You would think that maybe Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, George Bush Sr., George Bush Jr., Ronald Reagan, and Donald Trump, and of course Hillary Clinton, would also show shame for the wars they propagated, but not a peep. What is striking about Grant's view today is how remarkably forthright they are. It would prove unthinkable for any president, any of the presidents, to show any ethical misgivings about the attacks on Korea or Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq, despite the much greater destruction and loss of life. And you know what bothers me is the fact that the Clintons could not apologize for killing 500,000 children. By any measure, shouldn't we have a Me Too movement for those working in government or in industry who know of crimes against humanity that have gone undiscussed, unknown, to come forward and call those people out for once and for all to shame them so that never again will we listen to them, never again will they gain power? You kill 500,000 children, you're a genocidalist. And yet, the Democrats and the left and with the Bushes and the right, they're praised and protected, not condemned. What hypocrisy. Well, the defeat of Mexico consolidated U.S. expansion of its territory by almost 25%, meaning we stole 25% of America. Texas had initially been annexed from Mexico in 1845. By the way, just to give you an idea, Texas is three times the size of Britain. And the Mexican government refused to recognize Texas's illegal incorporation into American terrain. So in 1846, the following year, the U.S. declared war on its southern neighbor. It was unprovoked. President James Polk, one of our worst presidents, if you study his history, he was an idiot, degenerate idiot, mindless, stupid idiot. Most presidents are. How they ever got elected is beyond me. Only a handful had any intelligence, and almost none had any compassion. But they went ahead and invaded, and he was a racist also. And so, in all the time since, there has been little demand for domestic leader, for the Democratic leaders in the United States to return Mexico's stolen territories. Well, that's not going to happen, but at least show some sense of a gross injustice inflicted upon Mexico. Again, we won't do it. Instead, we hear hypocritical laments over Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014, a region that was firstly part of Russia. Do your homework. 1783 to 1917, it was part of Russia. Then, from 1917 to 1991, it was part of Russia. You can't compare the two. The principal purpose of America's war of conquest over Mexico was to gain monopoly over cotton production. In the 19th century, cotton was as vital as oil is today and also represented a key commodity of the slave industry. So control over cotton would bring England to its feet. That's what President Polk openly recognized. And so did his immediate predecessor, President John Tyler. Tyler said this, quote, "That monopoly now secured places all other nations at our feet. An embargo of a single year would produce in Europe a greater amount of suffering than a 50-year war. I doubt whether Great Britain would could avoid convulsions." So the American victory over Mexico in February 1848 led to the Treaty of Guadalupe. and it saw the U.S. take not only Texas, but understand what we didn't have that we then stole from Mexico, because we're thieves. We stole almost all of California, all of Texas, half of New Mexico, most of Arizona, most of Nevada, most of Utah, and parts of Wyoming and Colorado. And much of these areas were rich in cotton, with a conquest signifying an epic land grab. So in keeping with modern times, our free press champions America's illegal interventions, but we call it remarkable, meaning, oh, that new jet. Ooh, look how much we're spending to upgrade our deteriorating military. No, we spend more on the military each year than all the other countries in the world combined. There's nothing degenerating about our military. It's all lies. So just to put it straight, the next time you hear one of these people talking about, oh, go back to Mexico, oh, go back to Colorado, go back to New Mexico, go back to Nevada, Wyoming, California, Texas, sure. No, go back below the border. Oh, you mean everything above the border that you stole from us and you killed and slaughtered us and butchered us and burned our villages, that's yours now, and you don't see that somehow you've got this whole immigration thing wrong? Yeah, we got everything wrong. I'm Gary Noll. I want to thank you all for listening. Listen tonight, 7 p.m. It'll be a really empowering hour. Have a nice day, everyone. Yeah.